Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, Congress intervenes. The U.S. House of Representatives passes a bill to stop a potential rail strike that would have widespread implications for the nation's economy. Then, the risk of recession. Some economists raise concerns about whether the Federal Reserve's aggressive interest rate hikes are doing more harm than good. And searching for justice. Despite being disproportionately incarcerated, LGBTQ Americans find little to no support system upon their release.
Shelters are not letting trans people come in as themselves, and trans people should not be forced to go to one gender shelters.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Congress is moving swiftly tonight to head off a nationwide railroad strike. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted to impose a compromise settlement on freight railroads and a dozen labor unions. A separate vote today also approved more paid sick leave for rail workers. The measures now head to the Senate, and we'll get into the details after the news summary. House Democrats today elected New York Congressman Hakeem Jeffries as their new leader. He'll be the first black lawmaker to head a major political party in Congress. Jeffries said he'll cooperate when he can with Republicans, who will control the House come January.
We look forward to finding opportunities to partner with the other side of the aisle and work with them whenever possible. But we will also push back against extremism whenever necessary.
House Democrats also elected Catherine Clark of Massachusetts and Pete Aguilar of California to their other top leadership positions. The Islamic State group says that its latest leader has died. Today's announcement said that Abu al-Hassan al-Hashimi al-Qureshi was killed in battle recently. The U.S. military said that the Free Syrian Army carried out the operation. The group opposes Islamist radicals and the Syrian government. Former Chinese President Jiang Zemin has passed away. State media report that he died today in Shanghai of leukemia and organ failure. Jiang took over as Communist Party leader just before the Tiananmen Square protests in Beijing were crushed in 1989. His 10 years as president saw rapid economic growth. Jiang Zemin was 96 years old. Security forces in the South China city of Guangzhou moved today to stop new protests over strict COVID policies. Amateur video showed riot police carrying shields and patrolling streets while protesters toppled a COVID testing tent. Meanwhile, a rally-goers in Japan and elsewhere showed support for the demonstrators. This woman from Shanghai turned out in Tokyo.
This is the first time, actually, I've seen that Chinese people really stand out in public, saying we don't like the communist government, we hate Xi Jinping, we don't like these policies. This is the first time I've seen it.
Also today, China's ruling Communist Party warned of a crackdown on what it called hostile forces. In Iran, Kurdish protesters celebrated the national team's loss to the U.S. yesterday at the Soccer's World Cup. In social media video shot overnight, cars honked in support and people chanted death to the dictator. That was a reference to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. The protest began after a Kurdish woman died in police custody in September. Back in this country, President Biden pledged $135 million to relocate Native American villages affected by rising sea levels and other climate threats. Later, the president attended the lighting of the national Christmas tree. The tradition is marking its 100th anniversary this year. Another longtime tradition, the French baguette, has joined the UN's Worldwide Cultural Heritage List. Today's announcement recognizes the baguette, even as artisanal bakeries in France are in decline. The time-honored bread dates back to at least 1839. On Wall Street, stocks jumped after the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell talked of slowing the pace of interest rate hikes. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 737 points, 2%, to close at 34,589. The Nasdaq rose 484 points. That's nearly 4.5%. The S&P 500 was up 3%. And Fleetwood Mac singer, songwriter, and keyboardist Christine McVie has died after an undisclosed illness. The group rose to fame in the 1970s and 80s and was later inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. McVie was featured on hits like Everywhere. Christine McVie was 79 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, the White House campaigns to increase COVID boosters among the elderly. Despite being disproportionately incarcerated, LGBTQ Americans find there's little help upon their release, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Let's look more closely now at the joint efforts by the President and Congress to avoid a major railroad strike. As we reported, the U.S. House of Representatives today passed key votes to avoid a strike that could start next week. Lisa Desjardins has our report and then looks at some of the key issues in the dispute.
The gentleman is recognized.
Today in Congress, both parties fervently engaged in trying to avert a national economic blow, a rail strike in just over a week.
Every major industry, from automobiles to agriculture to energy, will be severely impacted if we fail to act.
It's come to us, as much as we might not like it, to have to negotiate this.
The House took the first step today.
The yeas are 290. The nays are 137.
Passing a bill to force a tentative labor deal into place. Back in September, skies looked clear as the Biden administration helped broker that deal with union chiefs. That agreement would raise salaries by 24% over 5 years and give thousands of dollars in retroactive bonuses to rail workers. But it only grants them a single day of paid sick leave. And that issue was pivotal to rank and file members. As a result, four unions, including some of the largest, voted down the plan and are threatening to strike. A sense of impending crisis was one reason Mr. Biden called congressional leaders to the White House yesterday to get Congress to step in and force the deal.
There's a lot to do, including resolving the train strike and the train, what we're doing now. And Congress, I think, has to act to prevent it. It's not an easy call, but I think we have to do it. The economy's at risk.
But progressive Democrats, led by Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal in the House, spent the last day pushing for a better deal.
CEOs have increased their pay, and yet they don't want to pay a penny, what amounts to about a penny a day for 7 sick days for workers. So I'm not happy about that.
As a result, Congress is working on two tracks with two bills, one forcing the original deal into place and a second that would force railway companies to pay for 7 days of leave.
The yeas are 221 and the nays are 207.
The House passed that idea as well, but the Senate can take it or leave it and still avert a strike. Rail owners have pushed back, with the Association of American Railroads writing that there is a misperception that they have imposed draconian, abusive work rules, saying these are long-held practices that unions agreed to in the past. Nearly all agree a strike could derail the U.S. economy, freezing almost 30% of U.S. cargo shipments and costing some $2 billion a day. Action in the Senate is expected soon.
For the record, we should note that one of the rail carriers involved in this dispute is BNSF, a NewsHour funder. For more on the railroad workers' perspective, we turn to Tony Cardwell. He is the president of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division. Tony, help us first understand what it is your workers do and why sick leave has been such an issue for them.
Yeah, absolutely, Lisa. Thanks for having me on, first of all. And I represent the hardest working employees in the railroad, I believe. They're the ones that do the maintenance on the track and reconstruction of track, tunnels, bridges, and they still do the hard work of swinging a hammer, and they operate some of the heavy equipment and do much of the work that maintains the structures and the track structures throughout the United States.
So why is it that sick leave is such an issue that your workers are willing to strike over it and maybe freeze part of the U.S. economy potentially?
Sure. This was the sick leave issue was brought to light during the pandemic. Many of our employees fell ill to the COVID virus and or were quarantined because they were exposed to it. And so in doing so, they were not compensated. And so our members lost thousands of dollars of pay through the multiple quarantines and sickness throughout a year. And it brought the sick leave issue to light. It's been exacerbated by the railroad's operation system that they utilize called PSR. And PSR has cut our membership to the bare bones. So there's fewer workers doing the same amount of work. And in doing so, the policies have forced the employees to be at work. They can no longer call in sick. They can be disciplined if they do so.
PSR stands for precision scheduling, which gets to what you're talking about. It's the way the railroads have said they're becoming more efficient, but essentially it's fewer people working longer, longer trains, faster trains, that kind of thing. But I want to kind of get back to what's going on with the sick leave, which is the critical issue here. It seems like railway workers aren't unique in having a pool of time off, vacation time, for example. And some of the railway owners, including the American Association of Railways, argue that railway workers can use that time off that they already have if they are sick. They say that unions agreed to that in the past. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, the railroads have said a lot of things this round of bargaining, and they're just simply untrue. Vacation has to be scheduled. An employee is required to schedule vacation early in the year. He only has 1 week of vacation to break up in many cases throughout, and he's supposed to give adequate notice to break, even if he breaks up those days of vacation. The railroad carriers are just not being honest.
This is a look at a major debate, of course, in American life right now, labor and sort of workers' rights and especially time off. But it's also a look at the role of Congress. Congress is poised to act to force you into a deal. It may have only 1 day of sick leave. It may have 7 days of sick leave. What do you think about Congress acting and forcing you into something now?
So we've been adamant. We don't want to strike. Nobody does. But if Congress is going to intervene and stop our strike, we believe they should give us what we would otherwise get in that strike. So the point is this, if Congress didn't intervene at $2 billion a day, the railroad would come running to the table to negotiate sick leave, but they're utilizing Congress as a backstop because they know under the law that they can intervene and stop our strike. So our point and our position with all congressional people has been, if you're going to stop our strike, give us what we would otherwise get if we did strike. And so if you're going to intervene and stop us, then you should give us what we would otherwise get. And that's why the bills that are being passed today, we're happy to see that it passed the Congress, and we're hoping that we can get the Senate to support the bill as well, because we have a belief that, our employees are entitled to this. And we need to make sure that we stand with workers. Our public servants should stand with the workers and not the duopoly corporations that are controlling our government right now. So we have high hopes that we're going to get some Republicans to stand with us and get the bill through the Senate.
I can see and hear you're busy at work with negotiations with your phones, everything going off where you are. One more question in brief minute or so that we have left. President Biden calls himself a pro-labor president, but he says your strike was just too risky for hundreds of thousands of workers, millions of people, and the economy. How do you respond to him on that?
Yeah, we were definitely frustrated with what he said. His statement was implied that that the railroad unions are the problem, and kind of gave cover for the railroads. In my opinion, we wish that he would have made a different statement and come out in support of our sick leave. But he has positioned himself, I believe, to support the sick leave days. And his recent statement, he did say that he hopes that the bill passes the Senate. So. He's changed his position on this, and we appreciate that. We're still frustrated that he took the position that he did, but that we can't always agree. So say that.
Tony Cardwell, we know the clock is ticking, and we do appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time, Lisa. I appreciate it.
The prevalence of COVID in the U.S. right now is much lower than it was during the past two winters, and its deadly toll far less. But COVID is hardly behind us. The U.S. is on pace to lose more than 150,000 Americans during this third year of COVID, and older Americans are at the greatest risk of dying. In fact, more than 300 people a day are dying from COVID on average, far higher than from the flu. And 9 out of every 10 COVID deaths are among people who are 65 and older. The Biden administration is particularly concerned about these trends and trying to encourage more people to get booster shots. Dr. Ashish Jha is the COVID response coordinator for the White House, and he joins us now. Dr. Jha, welcome back to the NewsHour. So these numbers we read are disturbing. 9 out of every 10 of these deaths, someone 65 and older. How much worse is that aspect of this than it was earlier in this pandemic?
Yeah, so Judy, first, thanks for having me back. We have seen over the last 6 months, 8 months or so, a clear shift towards more and more older Americans dying. Look, this virus has always affected older Americans more, but in the last 6, 8 months, it's become really quite extreme. Almost 70% of deaths are in people over 75. But the biggest issue here is almost every one of these deaths is preventable now. If people were up to date on their vaccines and if people got treated, if they had a breakthrough infection, we could get almost every one of those deaths. We could prevent almost every one of those deaths. That is our focus right now, is to try to do everything we can to lower that death toll.
And I want to ask you about that, but is there another factor or factors involved here in addition to age? Does it have to do with gender, with race, with income level?
Yeah, there's no question about it that there are certain groups of Americans that have been at higher risk. We know that people who are poorer, people who are racial and ethnic minorities, throughout the whole pandemic have been more exposed to the virus, have had less access to high quality care. That's been a major focus of ours, is to close that gap. And thankfully, in the last 6 months, we have seen the racial gap close. We've seen the gap based on income get much smaller. So we have clearly made progress, but we've got to really continue plugging away at dropping those death numbers for all Americans.
And why is it happening? You're talking about the need to get more people vaccinated and boosted. Does it just go back to that issue that we've been talking about ever since the start of 2021?
Yeah, it turns out if you look at, for instance, our death rates compared to many other high-income countries, other countries have lower death rates than us. What differentiates and explains that? It's almost all the rates of boosters among older people. That is the single determinative factor. There are other things that make a difference, too. As I mentioned earlier, treatments make a really big difference. But at this point with COVID, the single biggest thing that's going to drive how many people are going to get very sick, how many people are going to end up in the hospital, how many people are going to end up dying, is whether people are up to date on their vaccine. So if you got a vaccine a year ago, that's no longer good enough to provide the level of protection you need. Getting that updated vaccine that we have now really is the game changer that'll make the difference.
So I read that something like only 11% of all Americans have received all the vaccinations, all the boosters that they should have by this point. First of all, is that accurate? And second of all, what is the reason people are giving not to get these shots?
Yeah, so I think what we've seen is certainly in the last few months, we have a new strategy for how to help people get vaccinated. So before then, you were thinking, oh, do you need a third dose? You need a fourth dose? What are you eligible for? But we're now at a point where we have a much simpler strategy, which is for a vast majority of Americans, this is now an annual shot. If you're not in a super high-risk category, one shot once a year is going to be good enough. So whether you've gotten 2 shots or 3 shots or 4 shots, worry less about that. Worry and focus on getting that updated shot. I do want to put the caveat out that there are high-risk individuals who may end up needing more than once a year vaccination, but that's going to be a minority. For a majority of Americans, it really is going to be about focusing on getting that shot just once a year. Much simpler, much easier to do.
But do you have a better understanding now, Dr. Jha, of why people are resisting, why they're hesitating to get these shots? I mean, you've had now, what, almost 2 years to study this.
Yeah, I wouldn't say people are resisting. The way I look at it is if you look at surveys, a vast majority of Americans are open to getting it. The proportion of people who really say they are not going to get it is actually quite small. Remember, 90% of adults have gotten at least one shot, so people who are truly against getting vaccinated is very small. The issue in my mind is, it's been a hard 3 years. People have been in the past not so clear about what are you eligible for or not. And then the other part that's really important is when you think about the annual flu vaccine, most people go get that flu vaccine in November, December, January. So that's why we have launched a campaign right now to say to folks, this is a really good time to go out and get that COVID vaccine and get the flu vaccine. We think simpler messages that are straightforward, science-based, really will make a difference. And then one last thing, we are doing a lot more work working with community leaders, trusted voices, religious leaders, because we think at the end of the day, they're going to move the needle on getting more Americans vaccinated.
How much does it affect? I want to come back to what you just said. How much does it affect the prevalence of COVID by virtue of the fact that we do have flu? We have the respiratory disease, RSV. There's a lot of that flying around right now.
There is. There are three highly contagious respiratory viruses that are in high prevalence across the country. Now, the good news is we do have very strong protections against two of them, right? Influenza, this year's influenza vaccine looks like it's a particularly good match. So that's promising. The COVID vaccine looks like a good match. That's promising. And then RSV, for most Americans, not that big a deal. It becomes a problem for young kids, kids under two, who have small airways that can get plugged up if they get an RSV infection. So making sure that we have plenty of hospital capacity to take care of the youngest kids. If we focus on the things that we know work, we really can get through this winter. We've got the tools in our toolbox now to do it.
But it also sounds like what you're saying is that Americans should just expect that COVID's going to be around for some time to come, that they should expect, yes, get your booster now, but you're going to need another one next year and the year after that.
Well, for the foreseeable future, I think it is absolutely reasonable to expect that COVID is going to be around. We're not eliminating this virus. And so then the question is not just how do we live with it, but how do we live with it in a way that isn't killing hundreds of Americans every day, that is not disrupting our lives. And while the virus continues to evolve, Judy, the good news is we do too. Our scientific community has been hard at work coming up with new treatments, updated vaccines. And the key now is to make sure those can remain available to Americans, they remain highly accessible, free to Americans, and we do it in a way that allows Americans to really be able to use these tools so that they can go on with their lives.
Dr. Ashish Jha, who is the White House COVID coordinator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Word came today from a reliable source that the Federal Reserve may start to taper its string of consistent interest rate hikes as soon as next month. At the same time, the central bank tries to tamp down inflation. But that doesn't mean that higher interest rates are over yet. And as William Brangham tells us, some Democrats and economists worry that the Fed has already hit the brakes too hard.
Judy, the Fed has raised interest rates six times this year. Today, Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell suggested again during a speech at the Brookings Institution that a seventh hike, albeit a smaller one, is on the way next month. In a wide-ranging interview, he signaled rates could remain high for some time to combat inflation. And he said that while rising wages were not the reason inflation initially spiked, he said they're a key part of the puzzle now.
The inflation that we saw at the beginning of this episode back in March of 21 was not really related to wages at all. It was related to tightness in goods markets, largely due to supply chain issues. Over time, though, inflation has now spread broadly through the economy. And while I would still say that the inflation we're seeing now is not principally related to wages, we think that wage increases are probably going to be a very important part of the story going forward.
Many progressives have criticized the pace and the scope of these rate hikes. Rakeen Mahboud is among those voices. She's the chief economist and managing director of policy and research at a progressive think tank known as the Groundwork Collaborative. Rakeen Mahboud, thank you very much for being here. I know you listened to what Jay Powell had to say today. Were you at all encouraged by what he had to say, or do you still think that the medicine is worse than the cure?
You know, what I heard today is Chair Powell say that he is willing to do whatever it takes to bring prices down. You know, I think a more cautious approach is really warranted. As you said, we've seen six rate hikes this year, and Chair Powell himself said today that we have not yet seen the full effect of those rate hikes play out in our economy yet. So, you know, we really risk overshooting. We really risk throwing the economy into a devastating recession that would put millions of people out of work. And that's just not a price that we should ask the very people who have been bearing the brunt of higher prices to bear.
Do you look at the economy today, and we got some more good news today, that job growth is growing, that the economy does seem, it's maybe not growing as fast as it was before, but it does seem like it's doing better. Does that give you any sense that maybe Powell and the Fed have threaded this needle appropriately?
We really do have a strong labor market. That's been fantastic to see over the course of this recovery. And that's frankly a direct result of Congress and the administration's actions to invest in the people who keep our economy going. You know, after the Great Recession, it took us 6 years to really recover. We've done that much more quickly this time around. I am really concerned that Chair Powell's actions are neither addressing the root causes of the inflation that we're seeing today, namely supply chain snarls, a war in Ukraine, corporate profiteering, and also it's going to potentially really harm the millions of people who are really struggling with high prices already.
When you look at that pain in the economy, who is that hurting the most?
It's always the most vulnerable people in our economy who are hurting the most, right? If you're poorer and the price of essentials goes up, then you have less of your budget to pay your rent and to pay for other things that you need to pay. And that's always the case. So, and similarly, you know, an aggressive rate hike campaign like the one that Chair Powell is in the midst of would really, really harm some of the most marginalized workers in our economy. So, you know, economists such as Larry Summers have advocated for unemployment rates as high as 10% to combat inflation. When you unpack what that actually means, that means unemployment rates of nearly 20% for Black workers. That means families not being able to put food on the table, food which is already too expensive because of rampant corporate profiteering.
You mentioned several things that are driving this, supply chain issues, the war in Ukraine, and profiteering. The companies argue they're not profiteering, but let's just say if we take your argument that you believe that they are, what is a policy remedy for that? That's a very tricky thing to try to identify and to say, aha, we've got an example of you jacking up prices here, and thus we're going to do X about that. What would you prescribe?
We actually do have a lot of evidence that profiteering is happening. You know, my organization and I have listened to hundreds of earnings calls, and what we hear on these earnings calls is very clear. You know, CEOs are very forthright to their investors that inflation has been good for business and that they are raising prices on consumer in order to bring in record profits. I mean, just today, we saw, you know, the highest profits on record for non-financial corporations in the U.S. at $2.08 trillion. And so, you know, I think that's important to note that we actually do know that this is happening. In terms of policy solutions, you know, there are a range of tools that policymakers have to address inflation and higher prices. You know, President Biden recently proposed an excess profits tax on oil and gas companies. I think that's a really good start. I would love to see, you know, a bigger tax on windfall profits more generally so that companies start reinvesting those profits into making better products and bringing down prices and improving workers' lives, frankly, rather than padding the pockets of their shareholders. You know, we could also make price gouging illegal. 3/4 of states have a price gouging statute on the books. We could do that at the federal level and just say this is illegal behavior. And then finally, there are lots of regulatory things that we can also see, we can also do. So the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice can tackle the, you know, really excess corporate power and consolidation that we have in our economy that's been driving a lot of these price hikes and the pricing power that these companies have to jack up prices on consumers. They can also tackle exploitative and extractive behavior. So I think while we are often really quick to go to the Fed to address issues of inflation, there's actually a much broader set of policy tools that we can use in order to bring prices down.
I want to ask you about the sound we heard from Jay Powell, who's arguing that the tight labor market, which drives wages up, which a lot of workers love to have more in their paycheck, Powell's arguing that that's exacerbating the inflationary pressures. Do you believe that that's true? And again, if so, what can be done about that?
I don't believe that's true. I mean, as I said, you know, there it's pretty clear what the sources of inflation are. It's, you know, corporate profiteering, it's supply chain issues, it's the war in Ukraine that's been driving up the price of commodities. It's not workers. You know, worker wages have been really low for a very, very long time. I think we should be encouraged by the wage growth we're seeing because when workers do well, they're spending that money, they're investing that money back into our economy, and that buoys all of us. So, you know, I think it's really important not to blame workers who are already the folks who are really feeling the pinch for the crisis that we're in.
All right, Rakeen Mahmood at the Groundwork Collaborative, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Lesbian, gay, and bisexual people are incarcerated at a rate 3 times higher than the general population. But as special correspondent Kat Wise reports, when LGBTQ people are released from prison, experts say many reentry programs fail to meet their unique needs. This story is part of our ongoing series, Searching for Justice.
It's now called Doss House, but initially,
for T.J. King, visiting Doss House, an LGBTQ bar in Lincoln, Nebraska, is bittersweet. About a decade ago, King, who uses the pronoun they and is non-binary, meaning their gender identity is not strictly male or female, was a partner in a nightclub at this location.
We were one of, I would say, maybe 3 or 4 black business owners that actually had a nightclub. However, that was a period in my life when things were about to spiral drastically out of control. I was in the throes of my addiction. So,
in 2016, King pleaded guilty to possession of ecstasy and 2 counts of theft by deception, leading to a just over 4-year prison term. King had served time for other drug and fraud charges over the years, but this time they vowed to make a change once they were released.
This time I'm like, look, you're going to be 50. You don't have a lot more chances.
But King feared that a traditional reentry housing service, like a halfway house or temporary emergency shelter, would leave them vulnerable to harassment.
I'm going to be in there with the same people that I was just in prison with. I don't want that. If you're somebody that is black, gay, and HIV positive in the prison system, it's just not cool.
King's story is not unique. An estimated 1 in 12 people in prison identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. But experts and advocates say many reentry programs fail to meet their needs once they're released. Among the most vulnerable, trans women.
Because I was transgender, I was policed in a different way.
Jasmine Tasaki is an advocate for the trans community who grew up in Memphis, Tennessee.
When I was young, there was no term called transgender or no term to really help me understand who I was. I can remember as early back as about 3 years old, seeing other little girls and seeing grown women and literally idolizing them, knowing that one day I would be beautiful and knowing that this is who I was, right? But I also had the awareness that whatever I felt about myself was considered to be wrong, was considered to be untrue, and was considered to be dangerous for other children.
She was sexually assaulted as a child and later turned to sex work to make a living.
It was a way for me to regain control over my life, you know, over my sex life, but also over my life because sex had taken control over my life. As a child, you shouldn't have to go through that.
Tasaki was jailed at least 14 times for charges related to sex work. Her experience is common. A 2018 study found that for every time a young trans woman is incarcerated, her odds of recidivism increase. And it said her ability to reintegrate after incarceration may be hindered by the added stigma of being trans. Tasaki says there are few housing options to help stop the cycle.
Once they see that you're trans, you're not getting in the door. Shelters are not letting trans people come in as themselves, and trans people should not be forced to go to one-gender shelters.
Sociologist Joss Green studied reentry programs in San Francisco's Bay Area.
No trans women that I formally interviewed or met in the course of my field research wanted to or felt safe in men's housing programs.
He found that many women's shelters admitted cisgender women, that is, women whose gender identity matches the sex they are assigned at birth, but excluded most trans women.
They were disbelieved as to really being women. for the women that were able to enter these programs, there were then, you know, a series of other challenges connected to the harassment they could experience, both from cisgender women in the program and from the staff themselves.
So back in Nebraska, King says this time coming out of prison was different.
I knew it was going to be a safe space, and that was the thing that was most important to me.
That safe space was this home on a quiet street in Omaha called Leiden House. It's a free housing and support program exclusively for formerly incarcerated LGBTQ people, run by Black and Pink, a national nonprofit. Founded in 2020, it was the brainchild of Black and Pink's former head, Dominique Morgan. King and Morgan were incarcerated together more than 20 years ago.
Tell me about the first moments you walked in here. How did you feel?
Coming from a space where I lived in a room probably about the size of this, with six other gentlemen, where I was able to go into a space where I was able to close the door to the bathroom was wonderful. I was able to go upstairs and sleep on a bed with a comforter and a real pillow. I could just rest for a second.
Just hearing you describe how important the rest was for you.
Peace.
Peace.
Mm-hmm. And I think Leiden House, that's what Leiden House is for a lot of people.
You'll notice that everybody will have their own individual bedroom.
Andrew Aliman, a licensed social worker who helped launch Leiden House, says the home is designed to be affirming and comfortable.
When they move in, we give them a little welcome pack. And so in the welcome pack, there's like fuzzy slippers, socks, a journal that they can write in. Little things to welcome them and just say, this is your place. We want you to be here. We welcome you here.
On top of covering groceries and utilities, Black and Pink provides personalized services to ease the reentry process, like helping residents apply for jobs, yoga and mindfulness sessions to cope with trauma, cooking and budgeting classes, and helping residents navigate the healthcare system.
That could be mental health care access. That could be access to hormone therapy or just gender-affirming care in general. We try to keep a list of, you know, providers that we know are informed and affirming of LGBTQ individuals. And it's the same for people living with HIV.
10 people, including 8 trans women, have lived in Leiden House. Unlike some other transitional housing programs, residents can stay for as long as they need. Trans activist Tasaki oversees some of Black and Pink's programs.
It is a space for LGBTQIA people to come after they are released and not only have a safe place to live, but this is a place for them to thrive and experience joy.
But she says the help Leiden House provides is too rare. It is the only residential reentry program in the Midwest that primarily serves trans people, and only 3 residents can live there at a time.
If I had Leiden, I know that I would have been able to make better choices, but also I would have felt seen. But we want to have spaces for people where they are welcome and where they are celebrated.
King says staying at Leiden House for more than a year gave them the opportunity to find their calling.
Right.
Today, they work at the Nebraska AIDS Project, the only community-based AIDS service organization in the state. King aims to give clients hope. Something King says they needed when they were diagnosed with HIV in 1993.
I never, ever, ever want anybody to ever feel the way that I felt when I got my result. My main goal is making sure that the diagnosis that I have just given you is life-altering, but it's not life-ending.
King now lives in their own apartment and has been sober for more than 5 years.
Where do you think you would be today if you hadn't found Leiden House?
Had it not been for Leiden House, a lot of things would have probably turned out different for me. I say that because for me, I owe a lot to Leiden House. I owe a lot to them.
With the help of a supportive landing place, King is leading a life they couldn't have imagined just a few years ago. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Omaha, Nebraska.
And we'll be back shortly with a group of artists whose senses, you could say, blend together, inspiring some unconventional art. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. For those stations staying with us, we take another look at how Afghanistan's poets are finding inspiration after fleeing the country and the Taliban takeover. Ali Rogan reports.
In post-Taliban Afghanistan, the new constitution was written in prose. But the idea of the new Afghanistan, peaceful, pluralistic, and democratic, was cloaked in poetry. Starting with the lyrics of the new national anthem, written in 2006.
This is Afghanistan, and this is the honor of every Afghan. This is the home of the sword, and this is the home of the peace.
It's such a hopeful message.
Thank you.
Was that intentional?
Yeah.
Abdul Bari Jahani is one of Afghanistan's most prominent contemporary poets. He's spent most of his adult life in the United States, fleeing Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion in 1979.
This is what all the artists and the poets and the writers were doing their part in the jihad or in fighting against the occupiers. And the same role they played against the civil war after the Soviet withdrawal. Poets were opposed to the Taliban too.
Above all, Jahani wrote about the need for Afghans of all ethnicities to unite, a theme that the then new President Hamid Karzai wanted to promote in the new anthem.
It's about the pride we have taken in our country, in our history, in our present.
Karzai's choice of a well-known Pashto language poet was also deliberate. Poetry is central to Afghanistan's past and present, not just as a storytelling method, but as part of the story. One of the most famous examples, Malalai of Maywand, the namesake of Pakistani activist Malala Yousafzai. In 1880, Afghans were fighting their second war against the British. During the Battle of Maywand, the soldiers grew demoralized. Malalai roused them with a stirring short poem in the Pashto language known as a lundai.
Young love, if you do not fall in the Battle of Maywand, by God, someone is saving you as a symbol of shame.
These types of verses, usually written by women, are what drew Shafika Kwawak to poetry.
It's a way of resistance for women. It has been throughout the history against patriarchy.
But patriarchy was part of the Taliban. When it came to power in the mid-1990s, women were largely erased from public life. So too were modern music and poetry, except for the Taliban's own, which fixated on war and martyrdom. When the Taliban fell in early 2002, Kwawak was 8 years old. As a student and poet, she flourished. In 2014, Kwawak recited a poem at the presidential palace, paying tribute to another symbol of Afghan national unity, the flag.
I kind of glorify the flag as the flag of a land where there is love, it is free, it is prosperous, it is flourishing, it is youth, it is beautiful.
The poem, My Flag is Made of Colors, became a surprise hit, catapulting Kwawak to fame.
I was not expecting that it would go that viral. I think it was one of the most important events of my life.
I saw her naked on that.
In those years, the poetry scene that Kwawak was part of embodied modern Afghanistan. Men and women took part in Sher Jangi, a traditional game that's a mix between a poetry slam and a rap battle, like this one at Kabul University in May 2021. Just 3 months later, all of those forms of expression and the drive for gender equality were lost when the Taliban took over Kabul and the Americans withdrew. Kapal Wak escaped Afghanistan and is now in Canada.
I think I'm not only exiled from my country, but I'm exiled from myself.
For now, she has put down her pen.
This grief is so, it's like an ocean. It's drowning me, and I don't know how to swim.
Sometimes, though, grief inspires, as it did for poet and singer Gudar Zazai. Now living in Pakistan, he wrote Ak Watan Watan, Oh, Homeland, after celebrating his first Eid holiday away from loved ones.
We had lost our homeland. So in a very disturbed and crying state, I wrote the poem Ak Watan Watan, and then I was able to sing it with music.
Back under Taliban rule, popular music is once again considered sinful. Jahani's national anthem no longer plays, nor does the tricolor flag fly. What remains is the desire for knowledge and freedom. Some women have opened unofficial schools to teach girls beyond grade 6 when the Taliban says they must stop learning.
Do you believe that will continue despite the Taliban being in power again?
Oh, yeah, of course. This is how we survive. This is how we survive. And we will survive.
Those who think they can destroy our identity, culture, and music by removing artists and poets should think again. No one can take Afghanistan from us.
The Taliban may have reconquered the country, but in Afghanistan, history shows that the pen always outlives the sword. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Ali Rogan.
Imagine living in a world where music is not only heard, but also seen, where words have flavors and colors have a smell. That is a reality for some people with a rare neurological condition, and some artists are using it to expand their creative limits. Michelle San Miguel of Rhode Island PBS reports for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
I think that we're all lucky that it exists, because without it, there would not be the magnificent art that we get to have all around us.
Artist Alin Carlson has a neurological condition that she says makes her life and her artwork more interesting.
I was probably 5, and I started seeing numbers in color. 3 was yellow, 5 was red, 0 was white. 7 was sort of a purpley blue.
Not only does Carlson see numbers in color, but she says she can also hear them and smell them.
You've been open about the fact that you feel self-conscious somewhat, even talking about this.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, it's kind of because other people can't really relate to it.
Artist and musician Lenny Peterson certainly can.
So when I hear music, I see shapes.
What kind of shapes?
They are, they're in my art, and they're anywhere from a straight line, depending on the note, to all kinds of atmosphere within squares and circles.
Both Lenny Peterson and Alin Carlson have synesthesia, a rare condition where a person's senses, including the sense of smell and sound, get mixed together. We asked neurologist Dr. Richard Cytowic to explain just what synesthesia is.
It's pretty easy. Everybody knows the word anesthesia, which means no sensation. So synesthesia means joined or coupled sensation. And there are kids who are born with 2, 3, or all 5 of their senses hooked together, so that my voice, for example, is not only something that they hear, but something that they might also see or taste or feel as a physical touch.
Carlson says the artwork featured in her studio was created in large part thanks to her synesthesia. Take, for instance, this abstract painting. Carlson says she painted it by mixing colors that smelled like one of her favorite things, a low tide.
So I started to be able to pull in the whole family of those colors that smelled that way to me. It was like an undercurrent in the whole palette. And so from that, I painted a, 80-inch wide abstract landscape just from the smell, those two colors that came together. And that happened, boom, that was so fast.
Synesthesia is more common than some might think. Dr. Cytowic says 4% of the population has this union of the senses, including Lady Gaga and Billy Joel. Russian writer Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, also had it. So did composer and pianist Duke Ellington.
Is synesthesia more common among artists and musicians?
Well, we're more familiar with famous artists who happen to be synesthetes than we are famous synesthetes who happen to be artists. And it's a chicken and egg question of are they artistic because they're synesthetic, or are they synesthetic because they're artistic? But I think it's the former, that and they're used to unusual things going together.
It's those unusual things that inspire Peterson. He listens to music as he works and draws the shapes that he sees.
Now, these shapes appear three-dimensional in front of you. They're floating in the air.
They are being created in front of me. They're not in the room. They're forming in front of me as I listen to music. And the more I concentrate on it, the more they're going to form, and the clearer they're going to form.
Peterson's paintings are heavily influenced by the music he listens to.
So this is specifically around a Miles Davis song, actually, called In a Silent Way. And it's a very mystical kind of setting for this song. Then the synesthesia kicks in here. I start in the top left-hand corner, and I let my hand go. And it's just a free flow of while the music's playing.
Is it hereditary?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Very strongly so. It runs strongly in families. Either sex parent can pass it down to either sex child, and you'll see it in multiple generations.
Colorful experiences can also evoke pleasant sounds. For a Lynn Carlson, this combination of blue has a distinct pitch.
Every time I started to put them together, I would hear cello. I would hear cello music, just a long note. It's not a complicated piece of music.
As the paint is being mixed.
Yeah, as the paint is being mixed. When I would get still with it, I would just hear it.
What would a world without synesthesia look like for you?
I don't know. I probably wouldn't be obviously doing what I do, making what I make. I'd be lost. I'd be really lost, I think.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Michelle San Miguel in Newport, Rhode Island.
And that was just fascinating. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.